After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to the Metta Hour with Sharon Salzberg, where Buddhist wisdom meets everyday life. This podcast is brought to you by the Be Here Now Network and features interviews with the top leaders, teachers, and thinkers of the mindfulness movement and beyond. For more information, visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Sharon.
Hi, I'm Sharon Salzberg, and before we start, I wanted to say, please be aware that the following episode includes mention of sexual abuse and violence. And I'm delighted to be speaking today with Zainab Salbi. Zainab is a humanitarian, author, and chief awareness officer of Find Center, a platform for personal development and growth. She's been named by Oprah Winfrey as one of the 25 women changing the world. President Clinton nominated her as a 21st century heroine. At the age of 23, Zainab founded and led Women for Women International, a humanitarian organization that supports women survivors of war. Under her leadership, the organization mobilized nearly 500,000 women in 69 countries, raised $120 million in aid and microloans, and directly supported 420,000 women. She is the author of several books, including the national bestseller Between Two Worlds, and her latest, which is Freedom is an Inside Job. She's also the creator and host of several shows, including Me Too, Now What on PBS, and Through Her Eyes with Zainab Salbi with Yahoo News. Welcome to the podcast, Zainab.
What a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Sharon. It's my pleasure.
I mean, it's extraordinary to be with you at this time, especially. We're recording August 24th. I'm not exactly sure when the podcast is going to come out, but here's a passage from your book, Freedom is an Inside Job, that came out in 2018. And I think there's nothing that can be more relevant than this to this time. In the introduction, you write, as an Iraqi-born Muslim American who has worked most of her life in service to victims of war, especially women, I have lived through instability and unrest, have known dictators and world leaders, have dodged snipers' bullets and fought for justice. But this is not a book of how we got here or who is to blame. This book is about now what? Now that we see ourselves pointing our fingers in accusation at one another, what do we do about this turmoil? So I'm wondering about what spurred you to write that book and really what you're living through now today.
Well, what triggered me to write this book actually is so interesting. Many stories. I mean, I have seen my identity as an activist for the longest time. And I also built Women for Women and led it in the first 10 years with, you know, when people said, how did you do it? You know, it's like a young immigrant woman from Iraq, which was in a war with America. And I go and within a couple of years of my arrival to the States, I start Women for Women, a small organization that ended up having the impact that you mentioned. And so at 29, someone asked me, how did you do that? And I says, I am pissed off. I said, I'm pissed off at injustice. So I led with anger. Mm-hmm. For the longest time, you know, and I accomplish things with anger until a moment in which I actually was in Afghanistan, to be honest, which is what I've been working on in the mm-hmm. last days. And I was in a refugee camp, huge camp, working with women. And this was right after September 11. They were still in transit from Pakistan to Afghanistan. And two men walked towards me. And they looked like the Taliban, as far as I know. They had beards and the turbans. And honestly, I did not distinguish clothes. And in my own stereotyping way, all Talibans look the same. And I was scared of these men. And I whispered to my Afghan colleague, I was like, let's just walk slowly to the car. And then once we get to the car, like, rush out of here. These guys are here to kill us. And she squeezed my hand. And she said, we cannot do that. We have to wait. If we rush, they will suspect that we're doing something bad with the woman and they will hurt the woman. So we have to wait. And Sharon, you know, I worked, you know, I grew up in war, in the Iran-Iraq war. I worked in wars for 20 years and then I became a journalist of war for 10 years. I mean, like, war is my, I know it. I know how to work. And I don't want to say my comfort zone, but I know how to operate it. But that was one of the moments I was scared. My heart was beating fast and I was scared. I was scared of the Taliban, you know, and they came, these guys walked to me and my heart is beating and my colleague is squeezing my hands because she knows I'm nervous. And they walked towards me and they spread their arms and to shake my hands. And I was shocked. So of course I shook their hands and I'm like nervous. And they said, we are here to thank you. You made our wives happy. We have not seen them with a smile for a long time, and we are here to thank you. And the thing is, they were not the Taliban. They were Afghan men who wear their traditional clothing, and I am a foreigner in that context, who stereotyped as all of them the same thing. And, you know, I shook their hands and, you know, smiled and, you know, obviously was touched by what they were saying, but I was really deeply embarrassed by myself inside. Because in that moment, I realized, oh my God, I have been fighting for women's rights all this time. And I've been fighting against the stereotyping of women and cornering women as only this or only that. And here I am doing exactly the same. Right? I am becoming, and like, and this is the whispers in my heart that as I'm talking with them politely outward, I was like, oh my God, I am risking becoming what I'm fighting against. And that took me to a journey of discovery. It's like, you know, this anger that I have at injustice, and particularly as it applies to women, okay, it did do things, right? It mobilized hundreds of thousands of dollars to help women survivors of wars. It mobilized women. But it was chipping away from me, And I can't, you know, I can't advocate for something when I'm risking becoming what I'm advocating for. And so it took me to the discovery, and at first started by talking with men, you know, on trying to discover who are these men in war zones, you know, and I ended up talking with all kinds of men, and I discovered that they're the good, the bad, and the ugly in men in wars. I mean, my context was wars. They are the rapists, yes, and they are the ones who refuse to rape. They're the killers, and they're the ones who refuse to kill. And in the process of discovery, I was discovering my own prejudices and stereotypes and my own sort of a division of the world as good and bad in a very simplistic way, right? And it's then, and sometimes these conversations, they pushed it on me, you know, they like, they forced me to reflect on myself. The process led to freedom is an inside job. It started, you know, and if I am to summarize it, if it's like, the Freedom is an Inside Job is not an activist book, but I am an activist. And it was like activism from the broadness of my chest, you know, the shout. And then the more I worked on myself, I started realizing, the more I started embarking on my inner journey, my own inner private ears of really trying to understand, am I consistent in my moral values, really, 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 really consistent Or is there discrepancy between what I'm advocating for and what I'm doing? Even if they are minute ones, even if they are nuanced ones, are there discrepancy? And, you know, they are. Mm-hmm. They were, you know, or they are, and they, you know, it's a constant process. And then when I work on these discrepancies and what I call them my shadow self, you know, it's humbling because I know it's not easy to work on these issues. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh my God, here I am shouting at people to change, but it's much harder to change myself, truly change myself. You know, and it's easy to hide self-righteousness. I'm talking about really questioning every aspect of myself and mm-hmm. my consistency, right? And it became a much, I realize it's a hard process. I realize it's a painful process. And I realize it's a process that requires sacrifice and it has a cost. But it's a process that ultimately led me to an alignment with myself. An alignment in my heart and an alignment with my spine, if I may, my moral spine, you mm-hmm. know. So now I'm still the same woman. I'm the activist. I'm the one who is dedicated my life. And I will try to the last breath I have to advocate for the marginalized voices. I started with women and now it's everyone, really. But now I do it much more humbly, I would have to say. And I'm much less angry and much more compassionate, even to those I want to change, or I aspire to change, or I want to change, and even to those who I see as the other. I am much, much humbler in my advocacy because it's I realized that the rage and the anger was divisive, and I was not looking into my own inconsistencies. And when I did it, it's humbled me, and it now created a different level of connections between me and the other, quote unquote, the one I do not agree with. Mm-hmm. And when that happened, a new level of conversations did happen. And I think there are more results happen. Do they always succeed? No. But is it more in alignment with my soul? Yes. Mm. And is it worth it? Yes. And did it give me my own freedom within? Not as an external freedom, as in democracy or mobility or whatever, but as a freedom within myself, owning my own truest voice and speaking it every moment with grace. I try. I don't succeed always. It's a laugh if I succeed always, but I try. I'm much more conscious about it right now than I've ever been. And it led to the birth of freedom is an inside job.
Mm. Thank you so much for saying that. I think so many people are kind of anxious or reluctant to think about that kind of inner work because they feel that they will lose the edge that is leading them to be so involved or so active, and that they'll kind of think, yeah, it's all right, it's the world, what to do, you know, whatever, the images of somebody. And it's hard to understand how many sources we can find energy from and commitment and courage and so on, because most of us, you know, have not been exposed to a wide variety of models, you know, and that kind of effort has, you know, by necessity come from outrage so often. And yet, you know, there often is a cost. And it's like when I wrote Real Change, which was my last book, I had this thought, you know, just a random thought. I thought, oh, you know what? I want to quote Gandhi when he talked about, and I don't want to imply that this is about feeling anger. It's about being consumed by anger. You know, so I had the thought, oh, I want to quote Gandhi when he said, you know, to be lost in anger is to drink poison thinking it's going to kill the other guys. So then I looked it up because I wanted to quote it. And I never saw it once attributed to Gandhi. I saw it attributed to Oprah Winfrey and the Buddha and the Big Book of AA and, you know, a variety of other sources. I have no idea who said it, but there's something in there, you know, about compassion for oneself and how that doesn't lead us to be weak or passive or not care, but to act from a different place.
I love, love what you just shared. And I was one of the people who I was afraid of working on my inner mm-hmm. self because I lose my mojo, if you may, my charm, mm-hmm. right? And the truth is, I thought I did. You know, like I left the organization I founded and led for 20 years. And I thought and I went to another journey and I thought like, I have calmed down. I thought I have matured. I mean, like not matured, I'm proud of my work, but I mean that I've gotten older and maybe I don't have that charge anymore and all of that. And I always I'm sort of obsessed with the Indian goddess Kali, you know, mm-hmm. because I associate with her fierceness, you know, the woman warrior who, you know, defeated the enemy with her courage and sword, but lost perspective and all mm-hmm. and but killing her own army and almost killed her own lover. And that losing of perspective, I understand. I mean, you know, I'm like shows and all of that, and was one of the people who are obsessed with Game of Thrones. And the last episode or the last season, when the mother of dragons, you know, who fought for justice all her life, and then she lose perspective, and then she start killing everyone. And that was my biggest worry. I mean, obviously, I never killed in my life, nor will I. But that the idea that you are harsh on the people around you in the activism, right? In my family, my friends, because you're just obsessed and focused, and it has like, charge. It's like a Joan of Arc, you know, kind of mm-hmm. charge. But and the flip side, as I the more I start working on myself, the more I indeed. As I said, got kinder and I started in the last 2 years, to be honest, I've been like gardening and much more worried about my garden and my fruits and my vegetables and my flowers and all of that. And I see the world is going through things and I'm like, I am, in my 50s now, I'm like in a different phase. And then Afghanistan happened. Mm-hmm. And this is like within a week's time, basically. And I hear our sisters there have been assassinated steadily, one by one, in a very surgical operation by the Taliban. And then I got a call from someone that's like, we need to get them out. And Sharon, if I was a Kali before, fine. And this is good and bad because there was a harshness, right, in that energy. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, a gardener in the last years, walking barefoot in my garden and just, in a different universe. And I thought that I had put the armors down and I'm in a different phase of my life. Oh my God. It was like the awakening of the Jedi, my friend told me, the return of the Jedi to Star Wars, and I was just like, what? Our sisters are in danger. And again, governments don't pay attention to their rescue. Mm-hmm. And I tell you, within a week, I cannot say only I, because they've just been amazing women. We mobilize millions of dollars, security operations, all kinds of operations, communication to talk with our sisters in Afghanistan to make sure that we get them to safety and to make sure that there is a plan B for those who stay behind. And, and talking, everyone, it's unbelievable. I've been talking with women I know and I don't know. We're sending each other supports and communicating with each other, and we had over other women to each other. It's unbelievable. So I did not lose it. Mm-hmm. I did not lose that energy and that charge. I did not. It's still there with me. But I am also the woman who meditates every day now. And mm-hmm. I'm also the woman who gardens. And I'm also the woman who is so much more anchored in my heart and in myself and to God and to earth. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a way. Honestly, have you done this interview 2 weeks ago? I would have said, I don't know. But now I can be a warrior and I can be a gardener and I can be fierce and I can be kind. And these things do not have to contradict each other. They can be the same, but we can still do it with kindness to ourselves, to each other, and to the divine and to earth. We can still do our charge and change and activism with far more kindness to ourselves, to each other, and to earth and to the divine. You know, so it made me believe, oh no, it's still there. I will continue to do all I can to help. Mm-hmm. But with a different energy and a different force that is much better to me and to others.
Well, thank you for all you do. And, you know, I think people can feel the relentlessness, like you're not giving up, you know, and your energy is so profound and it's so fierce and it's so great. And the world certainly needs it. And, you know, those women certainly need it right now, but it's also inviting for the rest of us to think, well, what can I do? You know, how can I be involved? And so it's really pretty tremendous. And you actually taught me something about compassion quite a number of years ago.
I did.
You
oh.
did.
Okay, wow.
Yeah, I don't think it was the first time we met. I'm sure it wasn't, but we were together in Washington, D.C. at this conference. And you said something in your presentation about having gone to some war-torn country, met a woman whose story was dreadful, and you were going to come back and relay her story so that people's compassion could be awakened and they could feel how terrible the situation was and participate and donate and, you know, really start to help people. And you said something like, at some point in considering this woman and the terrible travail she'd been through, that you realized, oh, I forgot that she was also a lawyer. You know, I forgot that she had resource, inner resource. She had skills. She had kind of like inner beauty, you know, like, and you said, I realized that wasn't really compassion because I was missing a whole part of who she was. Yeah. And I'd somehow disconnected from the fullness of her being in that kind of singular focus mm-hmm. on the problems and the difficulties.
And it's, you know, when we do that and we do that, you know, as like now everyone is talking about Afghan women, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And we drop all their identities, mm-hmm. make them into a singular identity, Afghan woman, oppressed woman, right? And, you know, I'm a woman from Iraq, yeah, you know, yeah. It's the same stereotype, you know, and I have to, and I'm a Muslim woman, right? And when people reduce my identity or my people's identity to only oppressed women, mm-hmm. or only oppressive men, or only terrorists and all of that, it is a violation. It is a mental and emotional violation because it is erasing the beauty, the kindness, the love of one's culture and one's beliefs and one's families. And to erase it and just say, those people means this, mm-hmm. I can't tell you how much it upsets me. Now, it always upsets me. Here's the difference. And this is to tell you that the reform after working on the freedom is an inside job. Before, someone gives me a stereotype of my people, let's say, right? And says, oh, Muslims are all terrorists and all of that. I would just like get very angry and get upset, you know, because it's not true and it's a violation. And yes, they are people who are Muslims who are horrible criminals, mm-hmm. just like there are people who are Christians and Buddhists and Jewish, mm-hmm. and all kinds who are horrible criminals. And I'm not talking about only mundane criminals. I'm talking also about terrorists and have done some horrible things in the world, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Like, yes, it's true. But by far, they do not represent an entire civilizations and nations and countries and cultures. Like, it's impossible to say all Christians are one thing. Impossible, mm-hmm. right? Or all Americans are one thing. Mm-hmm. Or all Texans are one thing. So, like, it's impossible. So that's how it feels. So before, I would get upset. And, you know, and when I would get upset at the person who was saying, you know, I could see it. They were shut down. Their walls drops down immediately. And I could see it. And it becomes a competition of who's right and who's wrong, you know, an ego competition. I'm right. They're wrong. And they're saying they're right. And I'm wrong. And that. And now when I hear this, because these stereotypes have not changed necessarily, I'm using one of them only, right? And now I'm just like, okay, what are they afraid of? Or I actually acknowledge, either I ask, what are you afraid of? Or acknowledge the fear, because I know this fear, people are worried about their own lives or their own, you know, life, way of life or culture or country, whatever. And they acknowledge that fear. And often to help me in that, I must show my own vulnerability and my own fear. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I imagine it two people having two walls between them. And the only way to truly see each other, to truly see each other, is for one of us to take a leap of faith and drop the walls around us. And that's, you know, for me, is I have to take that leap of faith. If I want to drop the walls, then I have to take that leap of faith and show vulnerability and show what I'm scared of and show my hurt and show my feelings in an authentic and truthful way, not in a defensive way. And 90%, when I did that, 90%, the other person who I would say, oh my God, you're racist, prejudiced, da-da, sexist, da-da, all of these things. You know, when I tell them these labels, they shut down. Mm-hmm. They become defensive. When I say, this is, what are you afraid of? And where is that fear coming? And then acknowledge the fear that I can acknowledge and correct the fear that I think it is not correct. It's a stereotype, and tell them about my own feelings and my fear. 90% people say, thank you so much for speaking with us like this. Come around. Thank you so much for not yelling at us. Thank you so much for educating us. Thank you so much for opening our eyes. But they do not put their walls. And then there is a 10% who, yes, is helpless. But it's, you know, so yes, I can't say it's 100% guarantee, you know, mm-hmm. but at least I did not lose myself. I did not get into my self-righteousness and then, yes, demonstrate my point of view, but have a bitter taste in myself, mm-hmm. my mouth, because I was aggressive or I was mean or I was, it's because these others are like this, right? And so that's what I call, like, how do we compassionately go about our activism from a place of humbleness? And there's a place of fierceness. Mm-hmm. I am in this fierce moment right now as I speak with you, mm-hmm. with our sisters in Afghanistan. But even in that fierceness is how do we speak with the other where we bring them as allies, rather than disconnect them and separate them and create even further division, you know? And so, and to do that, one of the ways to do that is to speak about each other in their fullness of identity, to go back to your story, in the fullness of identity. She can be a victim of war and a lawyer and educated and has a lipstick on and raped and displaced, and they're all true. Mm-hmm. They're all true. We don't have to separate and limit one's identity to one or the other.
So I reread your book to prepare for the podcast, and I was really struck by the story of the Zen retreat that you attended, because it was such a turning point in terms of kind of the stories we adapt about who we are and who we're supposed to be and what other people have told us we're supposed to be, and actually loosening the grip of all of that. So I was wondering if you could say something about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's it happened right after Trump got elected, and it was an imposed a Muslim ban. And, you know, I mean, I am an immigrant here, mm-hmm. and I, you know, one of the people who can't go back to my country is destroyed. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's literally destroyed, you know. Yeah. My entire family, except for an uncle and an aunt, are all refugees right now in the last 20 years after the Iraq invasion. And so when the Muslim ban happened, it was really shaking to my core, like, because this is America is where I'm safe, mm-hmm. right? This mm-hmm. is home. And I love this country. And then I'm told, you may be evicted from this country and you may be, you know, like, I'm not welcome. Then it was shaking to my core. And it was also a turbulent time in America, you know, yeah. right before the election. And so, and I had done, you know, I had done some major project in the Middle East for Arab women, and it wasn't going very well. So I went to this Zen retreat because I needed to be silent, not because I didn't know much actually about Zen Buddhism. You know, I just really needed to be silent. And it was really amazing because the first day my brain was chattery, you know, all of that. The next day it was chatting, but it was it went to all the points that I had talked about, like I was worried about. And it dug deeper and deeper and deeper into this. Like, you know, it's almost like you have a pimple and you like the pus come out, right? And I just went with that, with every point that was in my mind. And the third day, I was even embarrassed to say it for the longest time, is I felt I failed. Mm-hmm. I failed in this project that I had put all myself in it, you know, a show for women in the Middle East. And, you know, it got the praises of Oprah, as you mentioned, and many others in the Western world, but in the Arab world, it did not. It got, if anything, I got attacked. And so I felt I failed, and I was embarrassed that I failed, especially after my success at Women for Women. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, the third day when I called it, you know, it was failure. I called it. It's like, oh my God, that is why I'm so obsessing about this. Fourth day, my soul felt like flying out of my body in absolute liberation and joy. And it was just because I had it's broken away from whatever I called the fear. I called it. I was afraid to call it that I failed. Mm-hmm. Right. And once that happened, I was joyful. And I just remember the joyfulness in my soul. I actually felt it's outside of my body. It was unbelievable. And I came home after that and I called all the people who supported me to make that show possible. And I said, I failed. Mm-hmm. I called them and I told them the truth of how I felt. You know, and I was like, this is how I felt. This is how I feel. I am really sorry. I'm embarrassed that I failed, but I need to tell you I failed. And the most beautiful thing happened. I mean, almost everyone hugged me, or if it was a call, they laughed even. They're like, are you kidding? Mm-hmm. You know, not at all. You know, you're defining it like this, but we see it like this. Not at all. And some people's like, are you kidding? We're just doubling what we're like, you know, our support for you. And it just created, because here's the summary. I had to be honest with myself. When I got to the honesty with myself and calling the issue that I'm ashamed of, that moment of shame, that issue of shame, once I called it, I got liberated from its boundaries, from its prison. Mm. And once I then communicated it with others, I created more allies than enemies. I created more friends than cynics. Because I was authentic and truthful. And these friends that I called and told them that, they're like my soul friends right now. You know, like it was an honest thing, and it moved away. It's just it's gone, right? But I'm telling you, I mean, we don't talk about our failure. Mm-hmm. We're embarrassed to talk about failure. All these talks, we talk only about our accomplishments, about our successes, but we don't talk. And we do say, oh, people can't fail and succeed and they learn. But I don't remember many people talking about the exact failure and how it made them feel, which is horrible. Mm-hmm. Right? And yet talking with you about it right now and writing about it, mm-hmm. it did contribute to my, honestly, humility. Mm-hmm. You know, that I can't do it all. Honestly, freedom, my authenticity, you know, just like it did teach me a lot. It did. And what's most important I learned is from failure is that we have a choice of being bitter about it, mm-hmm. being grateful for it. And when we're bitter, it's because I think we're attached to the acknowledgement from people. You know, we're attached to the feedback we get from people. And I was bitter for maybe 2 seconds, you know, until I asked myself the question, did I do this project for acknowledgement or because I believe in that, or because, forgive me even for saying that, but because I am someone who really loves God a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Like, very. Or was I doing that as part of my service, you know, to God?
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is, it was out of my love and out of my service to God. And once I realized that this is what I did that, and I failed, and I, you know, forgive me, God, for failing, but I tried.
Mm-hmm.
I tried my best. There was zero bitterness in my mouth. Zero bitterness. Because I did, and I failed. I tried, and I failed. But it was for God, not for people.
Mm-hmm.
To acknowledge and to say, celebrate, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's and that was a turning moment in my life of letting go, letting that failure go and being grateful for it.
And of course, failure is quite relative when you're talking about the immensity of suffering in this world. You know, I also think of this time I did this project for first domestic violence shelter workers, for the frontline staff, and then for directors and supervisors of the shelters. And at one point, one of the directors said, I had to learn the difference between something that was urgent and something that was an emergency. And of course, now we are in an emergency, but even then, you know, there's a kind of balance that I think we can bring, and that's often left out. Like that very woman who said that when people were talking about how to try to change the culture of where they were working, and, you know, culture might mean like your body and mind, it might mean your team, it might mean anything. She said, I think I have to start taking a lunch break. And everyone in the room who did not work in a shelter was completely aghast. And we said, you don't take a lunch break? Like, isn't it in your contract? And she said, oh, yeah, but there's never enough time. There's too much to do. And it's so overwhelming. And people are suffering. But she said, you know what? I can't go on unless I start doing that. And as the story goes, you know, we were meeting with people in between retreats. And she came in the first time and she said, it didn't work. I closed the door and somebody crouched down and looked through the keyhole. And they saw I was in there, so I didn't get a break. And then maybe 3 weeks later, she came back and she said, it worked. I closed the door and turned off the light and I got a break. And I thought probably the hardest part of that whole story was feeling I need this and I'm going to do it. It's not selfish. It's not ridiculous. It's not beside the point. You know, I've got to find some way of getting some respite, getting some peace, getting a break, even if it's brief, so that I can go back with like real intensity and not just burn out. So it's very hard, you know, especially when it is an emergency. And it's not just something urgent to remember, like, I've got to sleep, you know, or.
Right. Well, I mean, the cause I came to learn the very hard way, the cause does not require us to self-sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever we are fighting for, this woman who is serving a woman's shelter, right? Mm-hmm. Does not require her to suffer. It, you know, and I learned that, oh my God, the hard way, because I squeezed my soul. I left nothing for me. And until I realized, when you're operating out of empty,
mm-hmm.
you are not your best, not your best. You know, you're short with people, you're tired, you're exhausted, you're miserable, however the symptoms shows mm-hmm. in each person, right? When you operate out of fullness, like fullness, the full sleep, the full meal, mm-hmm. the full everything, like that I take care of my body, that I'm exercising, that I am like meditating, that I'm all, then everything is a flow. Is a flow. And it is really hard for those in service to do that. Really hard. I mean, I learned it the hard way because, okay, so I gave, and then at the end, I am at empty.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the point? Like, where you, not, it's not what's the point, but like, you're at empty, you can't give anymore, right? And now I prioritize, honestly, I sleep very well. I have like my 7 rules for a happy day, I call it.
Oh, can we hear?
It's not happiness, because happiness is an exaggerated promise, you know, for me is contentment, but happy day is I sleep my 8 to 9 hours a day. I do. I drink lots of water. I eat healthy. I go and be in nature, even if I touch a tree somewhere, if I'm in a city, right? Be in nature. I meditate. I don't call meditation. I call it an appointment with my heart. I call it like but it is meditation. But when I call it appointment, I really abide by it. You know, I go and meet with my heart. This is 5 now. I do something in the art because it's important. So anything. I mean, I retaught myself recently to play piano. So even if it's 10 minutes of that, you know, and I work on my purpose. I fulfill my purpose for that day. And they're very basic, right? This is about drinking water, eating, walking, you know, music. But that's my happy day. That is my happy day, you know. And the days I don't do this, not very good days. And obviously, it's impossible sometimes to do all of this, but at least enough of them that are happening, I'm okay. I can carry myself through. So fullness, because fullness, our fullness does not betray us, nor does it betray others, nor betray our cause. Our scarcity betrays ourselves, right? And so, and the cause is not telling us, oh, for you to be a person in service, you need to be miserable. No, 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 no. For you to be a person of service, you need to be embodying what you're aspiring for. You want women to be happy, then you need to be happy. You want women to be free, you become free. You want women to be independent, you become independent. You want your children to do this, you become this. That is, for me, the cause. That's what it's asking of us. And it has discipline, and that does not come out of self-sacrifice, you know, but it comes out of fullness. Now, there are moments in time where we do that. As I'm speaking with you, there are moments in time when like all bets are off, but we need to do that, right? And it's okay. There are moments in history where we have to show up. These are unique moments that everyone has to show up. But that's not every moment. That is not every day. That's not every year. There are moments that happens and we need to show up. And there are moments that we need to take care of ourselves. And the cause does want us to become what we are aspiring for. Yeah.
So let's talk about this moment in time in Women for Women International and how people can help support that work.
Well, I no longer lead Women for Women, and I have to tell you, as the founder of Women for Women and built it from zero to, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars raising more than $146 million for women, I am as proud of leaving the organization as founding it, because it's like there are lots of people who can found organizations. Not many people leave the organization, but that is not even why I'm proud of it. Because in the leaving, there's a humility, because it's your identity becomes about who am I if I am not associated with the organization. And it really, truly led me to the search of who am I if I am not my job?
Yeah.
Who am I if I am not my books? And who am I? Who am I truly if I'm not what the society is putting label on me? And that finding, that answer, is like an arrival. For me, it's an arrival to my soul. It's like a ship docking in its base, basically. And that has nothing to do with who am I as the world labeled me. You know, it's who am I is an inner unity between me and my soul that only I know what. And when that there is comfort, then there is peace. Now, but I didn't want to distract from Women for Women. Now, Women for Women and many other organizations, to be honest, it's like, you know, now I'm like advocating for everyone and anyone who's doing work in Afghanistan. Women for Women is one of them. Vital Voice is one of them. Women for Afghan Women is one of them. There are many, many organizations. And these are different groups who are basically taking turns in helping different women in different cases, some to survive inside the Taliban, which we're very worried about, some to survive while they exit, you know, and relocate to another country, and mostly to like keep a commitment a commitment to keep the Afghan women's voices on and loud for as long as we are alive. I'm one of many. We will not forget about them as they embark on a dark phase in their lives. We will not forget about them.
Well, thank you for that. I'm just going to bring up a quotation from your book and then ask you if you would lead us in a practice, and we'll maybe put some of those organizations in like the notes so that people can access them if they perhaps don't know where to go to try to support that effort. So here's a quotation from you, which says, "Only when we tell the truth can there be healing," which I, you know, associate with everything you've said and everything you described in terms of founding the organization, leaving the organization, your retreat, the balance that you've looked toward, you know, ever since. And there are layers and layers and layers of truth, you know, how we stereotype others, how we miss things, how we learn things, all of that. So I don't know if there's anything you'd like to say about telling the truth.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have operated in this mission to myself, you know, is that I need to live the truth, tell the truth, be my truth, you know. And, you know, the truth is, Sharon, is not easy.
Yeah.
Oh, it's really not easy. It's to do that, to truly be in alignment with your truth as often as possible. It questions everything in life. You know, it questions what I buy, who I buy it from, yeah. What I eat, who I eat it from. Like, it questions everything. Like, it being morally consistent in truth is hard, but it is worth it. It is worth it. But it's hard because then you're not like everyone else, you know, and you're like the odd duck always, you know, or often. And it's hard, but it is worth it, because at night one can sleep in alignment. Like, you know, there is a sleep, you can sleep. But then I have to tell you, I mean, you know, now I have a new mission. The truth states. The truth is once you tell the truth, you get liberated from fear and the fear of the secrets, right? And so it becomes almost an addictive process of telling the truth, you know, because you know it has liberation in it. And so the truth stays. But then a couple of years ago, I was in a very good time in my life. You know, I had my show at Yahoo News. I had, my journalistic career was picking up and this was doing well. And I had a nice partner and all of these things. It's like, check, 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 you know, close vacation, career, yada, yada, you know, all of it, check, check, check. And then overnight, I get rushed into the hospital. I'm in ICU and I am, you know, struggling to take my breath. And there was a moment in which I truly believed this was the last breath. And in that very intimate moment, you know, there were doctors around and hospital and nurses and trying to put oxygen on me. The word that came out of me in that moment was not, you know, my accomplishments or anything. Honestly, the word came, did I live? The word came is kindness. And the question came, did I live my life in kindness to myself and to others? Did I live my life in love to myself and to others? That was the intimate conversation that in that last breath, what I thought was going to be the last breath. That was the question. Not whether I accomplished this or that. And it really brought me down to my knees, you know, it really did. Because, you know, there's a high when you accomplish things, you know, and it's sort of like, yes, I can do that. Like there's again, Joan of Arc warrior kind of thing, right? And then you fall on your knees. And, you know, and it took me months and months and months and months of healing for my physical health, but questioning my ultimate question of who am I? And that is when I had like, you know, to lead. It's not a meditation that I have. What came to me is in my hours of meditation, because that's the only thing I could do, was my heart giving me its hand and holding my hand and said, don't leave me again.
Mm.
Don't leave me again. So here I am, you know, from an outside perspective, it's a woman living her truth, living her purpose, da, 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 but that I was not holding my heart's arm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and over the time and the month I learned, the years that followed, I learned that the heart has its language. And I need to learn. We all can learn the language of the heart. It is wise. It is kind. It's wise. Forget about anything else. It's very wise. And that the only way I can learn that language of the heart is if I actually make the appointment with my heart every single day. You know, and that's why I call it appointment. My meditation is my appointment with my heart. And, you know, and I like, and it's like everything in life changed. You know, if I looked at all the ugliness of humanity, I started looking at the beauty humanity creates. If I looked at all the injustice, I also looked at all the things that we are doing good. And if I took nature for granted, nature was my cheerleaders in that time. And so I then decided that with a new reiteration of my mission, which is I want to contribute all I can to helping people to connect to their hearts, to each other, and to earth and the divine in a new way, in a new way. And because if I could do it, then everyone else can do it. And Sharon, you have done it much, much before than I could. I mean, so you're much wiser in knowing that truth than I only discovered it recently. And I understand now your path and your journey far more than I understood it 10 years ago. And appreciate it. And so, I mean, I always appreciate and respect it, but now like I understand it in my DNA. And so from that came, you know, Find Center. You know, it's a platform that my friend Neil Goldman and I and a few others put together, which is a place where we're sharing sort of the conversations we talked about. You know, it's sort of a find center and find your center is sort of a play on words. It's a platform for personal growth and development. So for anybody who's looking at that, to go to one place where it has knowledge and wisdom of all time in one place. And where we are sharing not our holidays and see what I've done here today, you know, to be happy, but sharing our journey of discovery of our inward discovery and of our finding our heart center. And it's been a joyful discoveries because, you know, we know who we know of teachers, right? And yeah. You've studied this. My path was different for the longest time. And now I'm like obsessed because I discovered this 16th century Kashmiri poetess and 12th century Iraqi poetess. Mm-hmm. They're all spiritual leaders who have spoken and whose knowledge has always been there, but just not resurfaced to the public in a new way, right? And of course, there is the teachers like yourselves and others who are part of it as well. But it's like a home where the play is the discovery of the wisdom of all time and our own wisdom, where everyone is a teacher and everyone is a student. And so with that, I would want to share perhaps one of my favorites poems of all time. And it's coming really it's a Rumi. I love Rumi. It's a 13th century Sufi poet. I'm sure most of your audience know him. And it's called The Guest House. And it says, this being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delights. The dark thought, the shame, the malice. Meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. And Sharon, you know, I've been raped. I have been in an abusive marriage. I've been displaced. I didn't see my family for 9 years. The house I grew up in became an execution center. I lost my country to destruction. And I tell you one thing, and I worked with women survivors of wars, and I tell you one thing, I am so deeply grateful, so, so deeply grateful for everyone who contributed to making my life story what it is. Mm. Even those who have hurt me the most, I am so deeply grateful for them, because they have each led me to arrive to my own heart center.
Wow. I mean, thank you so much for all of that. And, you know, you are such a model, really. I know you don't like to think of yourself that way, probably, but, you know, that was really, like, in my life, it was kind of the central question, you know, since everybody suffers, not to the same degree at all, but everybody suffers, and how some people confront that suffering, and they do get bitter and isolated. They feel so alone. And other people confront the suffering, sometimes much graver suffering. And there's some quality of love and kindness for themselves, for others, of faith, something that emerges. And I certainly had teachers like that. And I think of you like that, you know, very much so. So it's so important for us to know that, as hard as it is and as challenging as it is, that we can really create something beautiful out of our lives, whatever that life looks like, and that we have that capacity and we have one another. So thank you. And I want to say, to learn more about Zainab's work, you can visit www.findcenter.com. It's FINDCENTER.com. Thank you to everyone listening. This has been the Meta Hour podcast from the Be Here Now Network.
Hey, folks. Thanks for listening. To learn more about Sharon and her ongoing teaching schedule, as well as online courses and a free guided meditation, check out her website at SharonSalzberg.com.